Hello and welcome to another episode of The Code of Create with me, Cameron Blackwood. Today's guest is Tia Merunen. Tia and I worked together when I was actually doing my final ever assignment as a recruiter for an AI startup called Third Eye Labs. Tia is a UX designer and, just like me, a career changer. Tia joins us today to discuss the ins and outs of how UI and UX work, how you can break into a career in it, and the trials and tribulations of bridging the gap between technical and consumer. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you have any questions for either of us, our contact details are in the show description. Today's episode of The Code of Career is brought to you by the Zero to Mastery Academy. Zero to Mastery hosts a number of great courses, whether you're trying to get your first job in tech, or you're a tech lead trying to level up some of your skills. If you're still learning to code, I really recommend their original Zero to Mastery web developer course. If you've already learned and you're working already, I'm currently undertaking a junior to senior one and it's fantastic. They also as well have a new Next.js course, which I'm keen on checking out. It's great value at $23 a month, and you can get 10% off by following my link in the description and using my code FRIENDS10. Anyway, on with the show. Hi Tia, thanks so much for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm really good. How are you? Do you go by Cam or Cameron?
I alternate. I can't remember what I went by at Third Eye. I always just introduce myself sort of differently all the time. My LinkedIn's Cameron. You can call me Cam, whichever really.
I'm going to go with Cam. Nice to see you, Cam. How are you?
Yeah, doing good. Doing good. Enjoying this sort of chilly October weather up here in Scotland. Gotta love it. And yeah, spent my day working on some JavaScript, which is always a nice way to spend the day. No meetings at all. So can't complain.
Nice. I've also had a no meeting day. They are not bad. They are not bad.
There's nothing better for productivity. Sounds good. So the thing I like to do to let the audience understand you a little bit better is just to run through some quick fire questions to get started. So without further ado, first one is a big one. What was your first ever computer?
My first ever computer was a family Amiga in the mid 90s. I'm from Finland. We had a computer since I was about four. So it has been a long time. I don't remember the exact spec, but you could play games with it. And we did fight with my brothers about who gets to use it when.
Yeah, I think that's always the prevailing memory of a first computer is just fighting with the siblings over who gets to use it, especially that one family computer that everyone had in the sort of 90s and early 2000s.
It was, but I can remember like the floppy disks and the graphics so well. Like all I need to see is a picture of an Amiga and I'm transporting way back into 1995.
Nice. Did you have a game that you played a lot on it or like a favorite one?
I think I did, but my brother didn't message me back on time before this recording because I tried to ask him what it was called.
I think for me, I think I had it must have been Euro 96, which I would have been one, so I think it was an old copy of the game. And I used to always get Scotland to win on that, which I think is the only time they're going to win the Euros.
The majority of our games when I was growing up were always racing related.
Oh, nice.
Finland, motorsports, huge thing. My family was into motorsports. My all-time favourite game is still Crash Bandicoot Racing on PlayStation 1.
That was really fun. I remember that. Yeah, I was going to say Finland is motor racing, basically, isn't it? Like for a country with not that many people, a lot of world champions.
I've stereotyped myself in about 30 seconds now. I'm from Finland. Motor racing was part of my childhood. I had a computer since I was very young and I had a mobile phone from 1998.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that kind of leads me into the next question about your favourite tech city. I was curious if you're going to say Helsinki maybe or London. Which is your favourite?
Ooh, I'm going to say London and the internet. So far as like physical cities go, London definitely, but it's also because I only know of tech in London. I left Finland about 10 years ago, so I've kind of missed all tech scene in Finland. And but then so much of my tech world and my tech life and my tech friends and like everything around my life in tech is actually online. So the internet, that's a very meta answer, but my favorite tech city is the internet.
I like that. That's a good way of looking around the answer. No one's come up with that yet, and I think you'll be episode number 15. Yeah, good answer. I think I agree with that, and very much embraces the nature of the tech community. So Very nice. And when you are working, we'll go on a little bit more in depth into what you do for work actually later in the podcast. But what powers your work? What kind of music do you like?
I have two work streams. They are either Chopin, like classical piano focused, very much like Spotify peaceful piano. That's the thing. Or if I just need to get stuff done, it's, you know, Cher, Dolly Parton, Britney Spears. Absolutely. I think 2019, my first year at Third Eye, where we both used to work and doing my dissertation, my most listened to artist was Britney Spears.
I like the contrast there between the classical and the sort of like 90s, 2000s pop ballads.
Absolutely. But there's just like, oh yeah, and another thing is like proper 80s hair ballads, like Euro pop, Euro dance. Excellent. Modern Talking, if you don't know Modern Talking, please put someone. Louis will get that code flowing.
Yeah, a lot. 80s pop was, I think, there's something about how cheesy it was that makes it really endearing. I really like that stuff. Like, I grew up on listening. My parents would play it all the time, so I grew up on listening to it. And it absolutely slaps. I like to put on the 80s playlist a lot.
Absolutely. It's such a good energy level as well. It's like when you know that you just need to keep going. Like if I'm reading or if I'm writing like documentation or like really focusing on something, then it's, you know, Chopin. If I'm designing, if I'm doing screens, then it's always Netflix. It's Gilmore Girls, or like Gilmore Girls, Downton Abbey, Friends, anything that on the background on actual Netflix. But yeah, if it's music, it's like classical piano or that power pop.
Yeah, it can be helpful to almost have Netflix on as like an audiobook. I can't do it when I'm actually programming. I can do it when I'm doing more like admin-y stuff. But in fact, when I was working as a recruiter at Third Eye, sometimes as sort of background noise, I'd just put on Peep Show, which is my all-time favorite TV show. And it was just, I mean, it's got to the horrendous point where I can literally probably name every episode line by line. but it just makes me laugh so much. It's one of those, it's quite chill because you know what's coming, but it will still kind of entertain you in the same way.
I say to my colleagues that I have a millennial disease. I have, like, if I get distracted, I pick up my phone, even if it's like a really short distraction, and then I lose my flow. So having Netflix on my phone means that I have something occupying, like something's going on in the background instead of music. And I'm also like I'm not tempted to pick up my phone. So yeah, my colleagues know very well that when Netflix is on my phone, they know that I'm in a deep state with my headphones on. Don't come. Yeah.
Have you tried the app Forest? It basically, if you don't pick up your phone, it gradually grows a tree. And at the end of sort of each week, month, you get to look at the forest you have.
No, but I'm writing that down.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I was saying on what would be last week's episode with Howard, who was my old boss at one of my first dev jobs. I was saying I've been using that app quite a bit, but the problem is I always forget to actually plant the tree at the start. So I'll just put the phone down. And it works because it means I don't pick up the phone. Or I'll pick up the phone and then the tree gets withered and that kind of thing. So it's quite a good motivator, quite a powerful one. And I think as well, if you pay for the premium, there's an option where they'll plant a real tree for each tree you do. But I'm always a bit skeptical of that sort of stuff because I wonder how the premium's like £1 a month. So I wonder how many trees you can plant for that. But anyway.
I have a family member in forestry. I'm going to be asking about that. But I think that's also quite good. Yeah. I'll check out that.
What about when you are working? Would you say you're like an early bird or a night owl?
Oh, I'm a definite early bird. Mm. Like I'm a very smug early bird as well.
You were often the first in the office at Third Eye. I do remember that.
I am known to be the first in the office. Now me and my CEO, Tess, are usually around the same time. But yeah, I do everything. I wake up early, do my exercise, go to the gym, do everything in the morning. I'm usually I usually start work around 8:30. So yeah, to get my morning done, get going. Currently, it's what is October in England. It's highly annoying that I am cycling to the gym or work with the moon in moonlight. But yeah, I'm still an early bird.
Yeah, that's the only depressing thing about having this kind of climate, because here in Scotland as well, it gets we have very, very long summer nights, but it's I guess it's more like Scandinavia where we have very sort of short days. And I got in the car this morning to drive to gym at sort of 7:20, just pitch black, and it is just so like it's quite demotivating to wake up.
It's quite demotivating, but then you get to be a bit smug about I woke up, I'm doing it. Then you smash all of the most important things done in the morning and all the admin stuff. You've answered all questions, and then you can just focus for the rest of the day.
Yeah, it's a very good point, and I would say that if I was good at getting up in the morning, I'd be an early bird. But unfortunately, I'm not always the best at getting up. But I am the most productive when I do get up. So it's an awkward juxtaposition. I've tried all sorts of things. I put my phone on the other side of the flat. I use a light alarm. I did this. I had this phone app where the alarm would go off, and you'd have to answer 20 maths questions to pause it. And I was doing stuff like deleting that app in my sort of sleep. And it's really bad.
Well, I mean, as humans, we will take, like, at a pinch, we don't take the thing that is the best for us, which is getting up. We're taking that, how do I solve this problem now? Which is, I need to get the alarm off. I'm deleting this app.
Yeah, exactly. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it was an ex-military guy on there, and he was saying, you have to just shut your eyes and shout 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 and just jump straight out of bed. And I was like, nobody has the energy to do that in the mornings. I'm sorry.
Have you tried it though?
I don't think I would think to try it at 6:30. I don't know.
See, I would try that, except that my partner would not be happy with me. But if I was alone, I would absolutely try that. What works for me is being grandma. I'm in bed by 10 o'clock. I sleep a happy 7.5 to 8 hours every night. And that's how I wake up early. I do not do anything after 10 o'clock.
Yeah, I think past the age of sort of 22, 23, it's just, yeah, it's accepting that you can't stay up until stupid o'clock if you want to be productive the next day.
No, and then a social weekend will absolutely ruin you. Absolutely. Yeah. And like, if you see friends on Friday or Saturday, you need to sleep Sunday to make sure that you're actually productive on a Monday morning.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I mentioned, I think you kind of talked a bit about what you did, but you are of course a UX designer now, but the final quickfire question is, when you were a kid, what did you want to do?
Oh, that's a really fun one. I could never decide. I was very ambitious about everything, so it changed week on week. Some the most common ones that my mum remembers is I either wanted to be a dancer, an author or a mortician, or a truck driver, and everything in between.
I rate morticians so highly as an answer.
I was about 13. My mum loves the story because I couldn't remember what the word was in Finnish or in any other language. And I was just like, Mum, I want to be the person who makes bodies. And my brother was just like, what, a serial killer? But no, I think that's part of how I end up here is I'm fascinated by a lot of things. So like, here's a fun segue to what I do now. I'm a senior UX designer at a startup, and that fits exactly what I like doing, which is I'm easily interested and easily curious about a lot of things. So getting to do a variety of things in different industries and applying the same skill sets in kind of all kinds of industries and fields is the best.
Very nice. Yeah. I do like the mortician answer, but also as well, stuff like truck driver. That's a lot more kind of realistic because my one is like way out there. I think, well, mine would alternate all the time like every kid, but generally it was some kind of professional athlete or musician. And then most other people, I think we've had footballer about 7 times now. Yeah. That's usually the answer.
I definitely had that singer, that actor. The author was a big one for a long time. Then I ended up becoming a textile artist because I refused to go to high school or do academic stuff when I was younger. So I became a textile artist.
That's a good sort of segue into the start of how you ended up getting into tech, because that's kind of more of a textile art is an ancient art, really. How did you get into that? And then what was the road that led to you finally getting into tech in the end?
So, I grew up in Finland, if I haven't mentioned it enough times, yeah. And you have two options. You can either go kind of do a vocational thing after you finish your primary education, like your compulsory education, so around 15, 16, or you can go and do your A-levels. And I absolutely know, I was like, I had a high average, but I absolutely did not want to go out into academia or to high school. I wanted to do something with my hands. I applied to school. I originally was becoming a seamstress, like an artisan, highly qualified person that makes clothes. Then there were three pathways in the artisan school where I ended up getting into. The pathways were clothes, textile, or stone, and stone and jewelry. And turns out that if you're in like stones and jewelry, everything is measured in millimeters and half millimeters. If you're in clothes, it's millimeters and half centimeters. If you're in textile, you get it to centimeters and meters. So you don't have to be so precise. I became a weaver. I can also spin my own yarn at 18. But sadly, what happened is when I was 18 and I graduated, I became really allergic to wool and dust. Which meant that I couldn't actually do what I had just qualified to do. But I'd been active in kind of student unions and that kind of movement. I was very politically active. I ran for the parliament when I was 19. And through multiple segues, I ended up working in Brussels in education policy. So I moved to Brussels in Belgium when I was 20. And I worked in policy and training, kind of training young activists and lobbying for vocational training in the EU for 3 years. And I kind of, at that point, I got to a point, I was 23, I think. I was 23 and I was kind of peaked at that career because I had no qualifications. I was good at what I was doing, but I had no qualifications. So I wanted to go and study. And I decided that despite everything that I said 10 years earlier, I do actually want to go to university. I kind of tossed a lot of coins, had a lot of conversations. I applied to do midwifery and media and communications. I didn't get into midwifery, so I went to Goldsmiths in London and started studying interactive media. That's a very long segue into how I ended up designing and building websites at uni when I was 24. And God, I need to take a break. I don't quite know how I did all of those things when I was younger. But in short, when I was at uni, I ended up working as a technician at Apple. So I worked in an Apple store as a technician while I was studying. And then I ended up working at Depop. I worked in customer support, but I was doing bug tickets and helping people and just getting to that kind of more techie startup-y world. I was really into, okay, this is actually fun. And especially when I worked at Depop in customer support and getting to see what happens when you have an app. When I was at Depop, we reached 10 million users for the first time ever. And you have 10 million users. What happens in the background? How are features decided? How does an app work? How do bugs work? How do releases work? So I started to get that kind of technical understanding for the first time. It was great fun. And that led me to, after my undergrad, I went to UCL and did a master's in human-computer interaction, HCA. And that's how, when I finished, I wasn't quite sure if I want to go into design or research. I still prefer design, but ever since I went to Depop, I've only worked at startups. So even though my title is a senior UX designer, and I worked in Third Eye and AI with you for a while. So an AI-based startup in London, and now I work at Bayer Fertility, which is hardware medical device and digital medical as well. So even though, because I've always worked at startups since I kind of was a uni, I get to do all of it. I never picked what I like the most, so I go for very small teams where I get to do a bit of everything.
Mm. It's a good approach to have, to be able to sort of get involved in everything. And I often say to a grad, because for various reasons, I've had a lot of people sort of ask me what they want to do after uni, and I ask my advice on it because I've been a recruiter and I've been an engineer, obviously, and I used to be a graduate recruiter, so that's where the bulk of the questions came from. And my answer is, if you don't have any specific skill set that you want to develop and you're not sure what you want to do, I say get an ops job at a startup if you can. Or if you're a bit more extroverted, get a sales job at a startup, because you will be able to hit so many different areas, particularly in ops, and then you can easily specialize in what you do. It's like a very hardcore graduate scheme.
Absolutely, like ops, support, sales, anything, you know, implementation, kind of getting that, or like customer delivery, all of these kinds of roles where you get to see the business and what happens in quite a wide scale to actually figure out what you even like. If there's one thing that I've figured out is, so in my career that I summarized there in a long way, is about 12 years of working in all kinds of things. And the one thing is that you don't know what you like before you've tried it, but also what you like and what you want to do evolves all the time. There's a lot of things from my really early jobs. Like, I do a lot of project management. I do a lot of like managing complex workflows and figuring out how things get done on time and what needs to happen when. A lot of that is everything that I learned when I was working in an NGO in Brussels, managing EU grants 10 years ago. So it's just like, essentially nothing is wasted, and you don't quite know what you want to do. Just have a wide view.
Yeah, absolutely. Always keep the view wide. And if something scares you a little bit, go for it. Especially if you're like a grad, because you're at the point in life where there's no risk. Like, chances are, if you're a grad, you probably don't have too many things tying you down. Like, you know, just go out and explore something exciting, and, you know, variety is the spice of life. Work for big companies, work for small companies. I always work for startups until my current job, which is one of the largest estate agents in the UK. Obviously, as an engineer, not as an estate agent. But before that, I'd never worked for a company with more than sort of 30 or 40 people. And obviously, we got to know each other working at Third Eye. In fact, you have the distinguished honor of witnessing my last day as a recruiter, yes. Where I had a copious amount of lager to celebrate the fact I would never have to message anyone about a job again. Although Third Eye was a nice sort of place to offer jobs out, because it was quite interesting recruitment. I was recruiting mainly computer vision people, which was pretty cool. So in terms of if someone came to you and said, I want to break into UX, like, what would you say is the biggest challenge in terms of breaking into UX specifically? We've talked a lot about code on the podcast previously, but not really touched much on UX.
It's the flip side of what I was just describing. So the thing that has made my career, especially in startups, so interesting and really work for me, which is getting to do a lot of different things, is also the big challenge of breaking into and getting into UX. And UX, user experience, if we just think about what UX is UX by default isn't visual design, but it brings together the whole touch points of what is happening. But what really doesn't happen, and it took me a really long time to figure out, is you have a lot of companies recruiting for roles with a title that doesn't always match. So you might have a lot of companies recruiting for product designers, UX designers, service designers, UX UI designers, or like any combination of digital designer, web designer. A lot of these things that might or might not be user experience design, UX design. So one of the biggest challenges coming in is figuring out from a job description what that job could actually be. And is that what I want to do? And is that what my skills are? Or is that what I want my skills to be? So there's definitely a lot of like lottery and sifting through of like, okay, do they actually need a front-end engineer or do they need a UX designer?
Yeah, it's difficult, particularly with startups, that they can't decide or they need both. And that's a whole different ballgame, really.
Yeah, or they might need a product designer who is really strong in multiple areas, who's really strong in multiple areas, but then they're looking for a UX designer. And then when the expectations of an applicant and the company don't meet, it can be really challenging. Like, I've applied for jobs as a UX designer where I, especially early in my career, I got told, I was like, well, your visual skills aren't strong enough. It's like, but you didn't even look for UI. You never specified UI. But what design is very difficult. Because like, there's design is such a wide field, and defining the type of design where you are and versus what the employers want. Because if you say designer, people get, you know, pretty screens and pretty screens and fun logos and that kind of like visual pizzazz. But because so much of UX work happens, like, frankly, so much of UX work happens in a written document like Notion or Word or Google Docs, And in a sketchbook, before you even get to the point of having something visual to design, and same for product, or so much of it is research. And getting to that point where you're actually finding that job description that matches what you want to do regardless of the title. And that's the hard thing. Because if you're really set on applying for only UX jobs, like I want to be a UX designer, you might end up interviewing for visual designer roles because the employers aren't listing them right. Or you might be missing out things that you'd be great at or you really like because they might be as a UX UI or they might be as a product designer or a service designer. There's a bit of a minefield.
I've noticed that. It's extremely... because I actually know someone who's looking to break into UX at the moment, and it feels like every single job is different. I think the difficulty is it's almost like the job titles haven't been standardized to the point they have with software engineering. Like I know what a front end engineer is, a back end engineer, DevOps, whereas it can mean different things to different people. I mean, DevOps is still kind of that way actually, to be fair, where it means different things to different people. Like, I mean, in fact, a lot of listeners might not even be that familiar. What is the difference between UI, UX to you?
Yeah. I mean, there's a very easy UX is the experience of how does it work? What are the steps that, like, if we take a really, really dumbed down version, what are the steps? Let's say we're talking about specifically digital as well. We're not going to anywhere print or physical right now because that's where we get the service design. It's UX is a digital product of what does the product do? What does the user do? What does the user experience throughout that product? So if we're, for example, looking at, which would be a good example here. Let's say I'll take an example of a project that I did at my master's of, it was a dashboard, it was a dashboard for an ICU. So we were working at UCLH, the University Hospital, and their ICU intensive care unit. And you had a dashboard that was showing real-time data that we were developing. It was showing real-time data of what is happening on the floor in each of the beds in the ICU and what is happening elsewhere in the hospital that has an impact on the ICU. And what you see in the end of that project is a visual user interface. It has boxes, colors, every icons, data numbers. So you have the interface. But before we get to that point comes first user research. What is the problem that we're solving? Or here's a problem. How does that problem manifest? Then you get to UX design. How do we solve those problems? What is the data that we need? How could the flow go? What do we show on each screen? Like, so for example, is what is the most important thing to show on the biggest? What's the biggest data? What else do we show on this? What goes behind the next menu? Is there a menu? All of these things that happen, regardless of what it looks like, that's the core of UX. And then UI, the user interface design, is when you take that data and or you take that system and apply a visual practice to it. And is UI is extremely important because you can ruin an experience with bad UI.
Yeah.
But you can't save bad UX with good UI. Just because it's pretty, it doesn't mean it functions. And just because it functions doesn't mean it's pretty, but it's kind of, they absolutely go hand in hand. And UI is especially huge when it comes to accessibility, which is a huge thing, is accessibility and making things legible and actually work in a way that is usable first, accessible and usable first, and then beautiful and on brand and coherent across, especially if you have a bigger product family. What does it look like if you're on this app or you're on a website? Let's say you have a banking app and a banking website. Do they look the same? Do we use the same colors everywhere? Are all of our exit buttons the same color and same format? So UI is absolutely fascinating. I love doing UI as well, but that's the how kind of go together.
There's a lot of interesting points you've made there, and I think the psychology behind it is fascinating. Personally, I think in another life, if I had a better brain for designing stuff, I think I may well have ended up doing that sort of thing. And the accessibility point is really interesting because for me, I don't know if you knew this about me, I'm colorblind, and so it's
I
really
because I tested a lot of my prototypes with
you. Oh yeah,
colorblind.
Yeah, I remember I was your guinea pig at Third Eye. Yeah, and it's one of those things where that's all right, because I do a lot of front end work at the moment, and it's something that we really have to consider, not just that, but of course stuff like screen readers, which are really important. A lot of people rely on them. But even just something similar, simple as using red, green, and that sort of thing can be a nightmare. So it's the colorblind population. We appreciate the work you do.
There's a huge thing, and also like technology is a huge, huge driver for accessibility. And the thing is, the amount of people, the amount of users of any app, you don't have to be an app for a specific group of people. If you're doing real estate, if you're doing fertility, if you're doing anything, you get a lot of accessibility, not just people who might have physical impairments like hearing loss or vision loss, but also people who might have a different language as their first language. If you're working in commercial space and you have a user who has English as the third language, the copy that you start putting in there becomes even more important. And that's part of accessibility. It's like, there's physical and there's a whole accessibility of how can people who are actually using this use it. And so many times accessibility comes at the end. It's like, oh hey, let's make sure that this is accessible, like let's make it work for colorblind people and let's put the alt text. But accessibility, in my opinion, should be part of everything you do from the get-go, because you increasing accessibility of any product will make it better for everyone, not just for people with access needs. Making accessible products makes better products for everyone, because you just have to think about every step.
Yeah, because it's not even just that people might think that we're on some kind of moral crusade here, sort of talking about it, but it's not the case, because if you're excluding your customers via not making your stuff accessible, you're losing profit. So it's not just a bleeding heart thing. It's like, yeah, if you want to make more money, it's a pays to make it accessible. It's really important. And just little things. I mean, this might be a bad example. Maybe it'd be better if you gave the example here, but if you switched around the confirm and cancel button, my absolute bugbear is when people do that. Especially when you're trying to unsubscribe from some kind of service, I can't deal with it.
Hello, dark patterns.
Dark patterns, interesting. Is that like, we call it anti-patterns in code, so like you're doing something the way it shouldn't be done. Is that the equivalent in UI UX then?
Yeah, so dark patterns are patterns that are actively doing something that isn't good. A great dark pattern is, hidden exit buttons or swapping them around. Amazon is notorious for this, because if you're trying to cancel Amazon Premium, the amount of steps that you need to go through, that all of these things that are probably great for, like, they're dark because they're patterns that are used to increase profit, engagement, numbers, numerics, you know, reduce number of subscriptions, but you do it in a bit of a nefarious way.
I was trying to unsubscribe from service the other day, and it got up to the, I won't say what the service is in case they decide to reach out and sponsor. And also, they're a small business. I don't want to bad
mouth
anyone.
Sorry, I just went Amazon. You're welcome.
I'm sure Bezos would be upset. if you're listening, Jeff, please do sponsor us. I was trying to unsubscribe from a subscription service the other day. Like I said, I won't name what it is. But I went through the process. They did the standard, we'll give you another month free. And then at the end, instead of being able to cancel online, they put up a little picture of a quite sad looking employee, and it's like, oh, just call this guy, and they said his name, we're a small company, we'd love to hear how we can do better, that's how you unsubscribe. So I have to, this really nice looking bloke, I have to call him up and just be like, look, sorry, I'm gonna have to cancel your subscription. And it's genuinely guilted me out of doing it. I mean, I really like the product, it's like 30 quid a month. And they don't even offer a way to like stretch it out, so it's every 3 months. So people got to work out who it is, but that just really annoyed me, and I wanted to tell someone.
Tell me all of these things that annoy you, because they absolutely annoy me. And yeah, my friends and my partner get these examples from me. Like the first example that you said around switching cancel and confirm buttons is, yes, there's a dark pattern, but also anything that kind of breaks an existing mental model in a very small way. Like if you change the place of where that button is, because because internet and web and app designs, they're new in a sense, but they're also something that we use a lot. So when you do something that breaks an existing mental model, i.e. the idea that if you imagine a fire truck in your mind right now, that's a mental model that you have based on existing knowledge and experience of a fire truck. If someone makes fire trucks green, we stop associating them with what we know them. If you make, you know, if you make cancel buttons green, we get, it's kind of a jarring thing. And that's the, you know, UX is like, you know, editing a movie. If it's done well, you don't really notice it, which is a good thing because it's just a smooth thing. But if we start breaking mental models or we don't take those into account, it's like all of a sudden it's like, ooh, it's that jarring. You don't even always know how to describe it or what to call it. You just know that something's a bit off.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting, and it's crazy how ingrained it is into our brains. And I do find that whole side of things really interesting.
It's fun with speeches as well. Like you get to like you can get to a point where nothing happens in code, but like small UI or like small change in the UX, and your customer feedback starts being like, oh, the app is so much faster. Nothing has happened in the code. The performance is the same, but the experience feels faster. So you get huge benefits from small tweaks. Like
that is very interesting, because obviously I spend because of like the Coder career, it's just all me. I'm actually really bashing my head against the wall with the UX of the website at the moment, and I've been really bothered about getting the speed up to like first contentful paint and all that sort of thing. I haven't even, like, I'm now thinking about the UX, but actually I could make it appear so much faster by just having a smoother UX. So I'm definitely going to have a read up on that.
There's a great example from, now I'm going to be really bad because I do not have the reference at the top of my mind. If you have show notes, we can add them there. But there's this study I remember, essentially looking at, it was a quite classic one, quite well known. It was looking at people's experiences of a website where they could book flights. And they were doing experiments. So a lot of UX, and more specifically human computer interactions, so the field of study that touches UX and psychology and computer science, love child, a lot of it's based on experiments, and you figure out things like what, you know, keyboards, how do keyboard works? That's an HCI thing that works in experiments. So there was an experiment on that loading screen. So you put in your search terms and you hit search, and it takes a while. It takes a while to search. So they were doing an experiment on with different types of screens of what you show the user at that point. And what I remember the best is that, first of all, if it's too fast, people don't trust your results always, unless you're Google. Things that happen really quickly are a bit like, oh, but did it happen? Like, there is a point in which our minds as humans start jarring because things are too fast. And the other point was when it was just the loading screen, like just a generic loading screen, versus when it was a screen that showed what was being searched, even if it was a random list of like, oh, checking X, doing this, looking at Helsinki, oh, checking the weather in somewhere else, the exact same amount of time people reported the one with something content was faster.
That's really interesting. So I guess, because I guess the brain is working on, not translating, working on understanding what message is being conveyed, whereas if it's just a simple spinning wheel, it's like, oh, I'm just staring at this. It's like being given a distraction.
Exactly. And it's like, oh, the machine is doing this. I understand this takes time because the machine is doing this. And the examples that you have on the screen make sense. It's like, oh, I know what that means. Like, I know what weather means. Oh, that was actually really fast, rather than it's just a computer, it's just a blank screen. This is my favorite UX problem in AI. Complete sidestep, sorry. But this is my favorite problem with AI and usability and like UX in general, because AI is still, for the majority of us, is something either that we don't realize is AI, you know, chatbots, Siri, like we don't quite realize them, or is something that we think is very sci-fi. So a lot of the AI applications, when you actually get to lay users, if you get to people every day, actually understanding and helping people figure out how the machine made the decision is this exactly thing, like, how does a search engine find the flights for you? What do you see that helps you make sense of the machine? Especially because, like, a lot of the time, machine learning engineers can't tell that yourself, or it becomes a really long academic article, and you just kind of need to figure out what is the model, how do we represent this to you as a user so that you can trust the machine, but also you can, you know, when the machine is wrong, because, you know, no system is perfect. Every model will always make a mistake.
And any system's only as good as the data you feed into it as well.
Exactly. So as a user, you need to understand what that is. And this is very good UX. This is my favorite UX. Like now I'm helping people make sense about the ovulation. Also a very fun UX problem. But that's the kind of future problems of AI. Sense making of what is happening and why does the machine do that. And existing mental models around apps and everything we use daily, we all have an idea of what happens, whether it's depending, like it all depends on when you use and what you use, but like when you send an email, what do you imagine happens after that? You might not know, but you have some kind of idea, and then it goes back and forth.
I would love to do like a pop box kind of thing of going around maybe London or somewhere and just asking people, what do you think happens when the email gets sent? Just some of the wacky stuff people come up with.
Oh, can we please do that? Let's make it a Christmas special of this podcast.
I was thinking for the YouTube channel of this, actually, I might do some like pop box stuff. I don't know. I need to get a proper microphone and a decent camera, but yeah, it'd be quite funny. Because there's a lot of the big tech YouTubers have been doing. Like there's a guy, Nick White, on YouTube, who's very good, and he's been doing things where he goes around New York and offers people $100 if they can solve a programming question on the spot and that kind of thing, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's fun. And and at the end of this, like, it's all UX because, oh, now I'm just distracted because I want to go and ask that question. Anyway, it's all UX, it's all user experience, because you're understanding. Mental models are important because what you're doing when you are doing user experience design is you're understanding what the problem is, and hopefully you have a great researcher with you. UX research, amazing. Like, you want the research. Nothing in UX happens without research. And then you're understanding, okay, well, how is that problem solved now? And how do people see that problem? How do people understand this thing now? So that then you can, you know, start going on those solutions. And like, okay, this is the situation now. This is what people do now. This is where we fit in. And you have to fit in because you could have the best tech ever, but if people don't see the way it fits into their problem, or they can't imagine it, or it doesn't fit into any mental model of any technology existing, it's a big ask.
Yeah, absolutely. And my kind of question as well on this whole, I mean, the wider bit of this whole thing is, a lot of the people that listen to us are people that are either in uni or even leaving school. They're keen to get into tech, not necessarily even to code. In fact, the coder career is actually somewhat of a misnomer because we always have tech recruiters on here. We have entrepreneurs and now, of course, designers. What would you say if someone was specifically interested in UI, UX? The path is actually even less clear than being a software developer, from what I can see. If someone, let's say, for the sake of argument, an 18-year-old who just left sixth form came up to you and said, I want to get into the industry, how would you say they should go about it?
I'm also a really bad example because my career is such a windy path. If you want to take the academic route, study psychology or study design, depending on which science of like the UX and product design world you're the most interested in, or, you know, human computer interaction. Absolutely. If you want that academic rigor, if you want that research practice, if you want that grounding in academia, it's not like, I have an MSc in human computer interaction. I did do an entire design module, but most of it was research and understanding and that rigor. So it's very academic. Boot camps. This all comes with the caveat that nothing that you study will not help you as much as when you're actually working. You will learn so much. Like any techie world is, you get the basics and you get the kind of frameworks. Then you actually learn when you get into the job. So that's why I was like, boot camps can get you to a job, but you can't, like, whether it's uni, whether it's boot camp, whether it's masters, you can't get it all. And then the other way, just like with coding, as far as I understand, not as a coder, is doing what you want to do. You know, finding, because what you need to get a job in UX or design, you need a portfolio. You need case studies, whether it's, you know, volunteer for an NGO, if you have the time, do case studies, start learning things, take courses online on your own time. I recommend things that don't cost you any money or very little money. Do not do unpaid internships. We want to get rid of unpaid internships.
Absolutely.
In the world.
Absolutely.
Because unpaid internships, you don't need them. And they're also like just permeating really bad, toxic practices of who can afford to do them.
Yeah.
I'm working class. I can't afford that. Sorry, swore.
It's all right. We got the sense of bleep.
Cool. I get very passionate about unpaid internships.
Mm. Well, it's understandable. Yeah.
It's like the biggest thing is what you want to do is two things. Find a way for you to practice those skills, whether it's in academia, in research, understanding that like background, or whether it's in a boot camp or in a design kind of related study program, or whether it's on your own. Just do what you want to do. It's not quite fake it till you make it, but design, all elements of design, in my opinion and my undergraduate dissertation, is a craft. If you want to learn to whittle a whistle from wood, you need to practice. Start from basics. Really, really good thing that I have a great Slack community, a lot of people recommend always, copy existing interfaces, copy apps, understand how the flows work, break them down, do them yourself. Figma, you can do a lot with Figma for free. Adobe XD, free again. Get a software, start playing around, start doing what you're doing and building that case studies. And then when you have something you've been trialing, find mentors. Online, you know, Figma, Friends with Figma, Designer Hangout, a huge amount of Slack communities, Twitter, Design Twitter. Find mentors. Find anyone who will take time with you to do feedback, do crits, understand, you know, help you through that bit. Design is great for mentors. I have had excellent mentors who are all still my friends after years, but like just helping with that, like I'm quite new and I know the theory, or like I've done this bit before, but everything else is new.
Yeah. And for those areas to find mentors, we'll leave those in the description, people that are interested. Are there any free resources to learn UX in particular that you'd recommend?
So there's a lot of resources, a lot of free ones. And I would always go for things like Nielsen Norman, Jared Spool, anyone that is in that kind of UIE is Jared Spool's group. There's a few reputable sources. If you start searching those and start seeing what they're talking about, you can then also start weeding out what's actually worth reading.
Yeah, that sounds good. And my final question for you is I guess kind of relates to what I've asked already in that respect, but what would you advise your younger self about your career? Like when you were very sort of junior, knowing what you know now, what sort of things would you advise?
Ooh. So one of the things I already said that I find really really big is that every skill needs a practice. You only get better by doing that thing. And I have done that exact practice of copying interfaces, figuring out how to do these things and just copy what someone else did. What I know now that I didn't know back at the time is how good feedback is. I used to be absolutely terrified of feedback. Like this was in my early job as well, like a good 8-10 years ago. Like whenever someone was having feedback to me, I thought it was soul crushing. It was absolutely soul crushing. I remember whenever my first manager, Viviana in Brussels, when we had a one-to-one with her, I would go in full of dread because I was sure that I'm gonna get fired.
Well, I was terrified. I was constantly gonna be fired.
So terrifying. And then I went to Goldsmiths. I went to art school. I cannot draw, especially hands. And so I'm a designer who can't draw. You're very welcome. I do illustrate some, but anyway. The feedback was so excruciating because I had poured my heart and soul out to it. And I was like, I spent so much time getting that thing right. And it's like, this is the point where I'm going to get feedback. And what I wish I'd learned earlier, and I now do all the time, is share all the time. Ask for feedback all the time. The earlier, the better. Have 10 ideas, talk them through with someone. Have a first sketch on your notebook, talk that through with someone. The way that you open that process, make sure that you don't get to a point where you think something is perfect and you're so attached to it because you spend so long with it alone that when someone actually comes with good feedback and be like, oh, actually, or something that you missed, because we all miss something. We all always miss something that we were doing on our own, because you just can't keep everything in your mind. So feedback is useful in giving you those things that you forgot. But also you can't, if you ask for feedback early and often, and just practice that, just practice living with feedback, practice asking it. It means that by the time you get to the point where you used to ask feedback, you actually have a much more polished, much better product, and you've got rid of that dread. Like, I have like these really messy Figma files with full of sketches, and I take my boss, my manager George, our CPO, who I work with really closely. I just like, okay, George, this is everything I've been thinking about today. I tried this one, it didn't work. I tried this one, it didn't work. This is not really there. It looks quite ugly, but how about this flow? And it's just like, it's just not attached to it. So there's no dread. And my very final piece of advice that I would give myself is do not compare timelines. Personal, professional. I went to university at 24. I went to Goldsmiths, full of highly talented, amazing people, like people who are now winning awards and are like on TV and like doing excellent work. So many of my work, especially in media and communications, I have animators, illustrators, filmmakers, people who have amazing careers now. And these people have amazing careers at the point in which I went to uni. Being 24 with 18, 20 year olds who were so much further away than I was, it was horrible. I just kept comparing. It's like, I am so late. I can't do this. And that was actually not true. I wasted way too much time comparing timelines and feeling like I'm starting too late. I'm not 30. I'm a senior UX designer. I'm in the actual dream job. Don't worry, my previous boss knows it as well. Hi, Raz. And my current manager knows it. This is my dream job. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. And I'm not. And if anything had happened earlier, I wouldn't have been in a position to take this job. Like, it all aligned in the end, and I'm exactly where I need to be. Not too soon, not too late. It's fine.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I always worry about, because obviously I didn't get into software engineering full time until I was 24, which it felt really old at the time. It's like, really, in the grand scheme of things, I wasn't even 25 yet. And it's like, comparison is just a thief of joy. Like, I let that really bother me for so long. And now I just don't care. Like, Colonel Sanders didn't open his first KFC until he was in his 60s. Like, if the Colonel can do that, then, I think I'll live with not writing JavaScript until my 22nd birthday, you know. So it's fine. And I think that's great advice. And definitely people listening, just compare to yourself to where you were yesterday. And another nice saying I like is the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
Absolutely. And everything that you do in between, especially somewhere like UX, which is so user and human and cross-disciplinary field, is everything that you do in between helps. Like, if you end up in UX, whatever you did before, there's very few things that do not help you. Like, I've done so many things. Like, had my first, the first time I actually got paid as a UX designer, despite, you know, doing things like design and things at uni and working in tech, but when I actually got paid salary as a UX designer full time, I was 26 or 27. But it didn't mean that that was my day one. It didn't mean that that was the first time I learned anything. I learned and done so many different things that worked in my favor and I still use all the time now. And like, just because that was when the title started doesn't mean that that's when the work started.
Yeah, definitely. Couldn't agree more. I feel the same way. Like, I've started writing code way before I got my first job, and you already learned so many lessons through that. So,
and you're a tech recruiter. Like,
yeah.
Like, there's so much that you do before that helps you, and you're like, all of a sudden, I was like, wait.
I knew all the buzzwords.
Yes.
I knew Java and JavaScript wasn't the same thing, which is shockingly more than could be said for a lot of recruiters. Anyway, before I badmouth too many tech recruiters, sorry, I get messages these days that just would have annoyed me to no end. They annoy me to no end now, but they would have annoyed me to no end if one of my colleagues has sent it out as a tech recruiter.
Don't worry. People... Technically, I know HTML, CSS, and a little bit of like jQuery, but nothing bugs me like a job ad looking for UX designer who can code. Oh. Those are two jobs. Pay for two people.
Yeah, it's just, I always love that tweet where the guy said, oh, you're looking for JavaScript, Java, Python, Docker, Kubernetes. You're not recruiting a developer, you're recruiting an IT department. people love to, the jack of all trades, master and master of none and all that. But
caveat. Understanding what happens helps you design actually things that can be built. But you don't need to know that yourself. You need to work closely with your engineers.
Absolutely.
Have an engineer, work closely with them. Go through whatever it is. It's like, my favorite thing to ask anyone, every engineer that I work with, is how much do you hate me if we do this? Because there's a possible and there is, this is really difficult to do. And this is what makes sense for us to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something where I've learned that working with a great designer is just the best way to be a good developer, because it makes life so much easier once we know what's going on. And it's pretty great. So
there's a whole other podcast that I could talk about just like working with engineers. Working with engineers is the best. Go and do it.
Absolutely. In terms of what you're working on at the moment, have you got anything to shout out, like any vacancies at the startup you're at or anything like that?
We don't have vacancies yet at this stage. So I work at Bayer Fertility. What we're doing is we are bringing to the market a at-home fertility treatment. So we're bringing a old-fashioned clinical treatment and bringing it into the 21st century, kicking and screaming. It's called cervical cap insemination. But what it means is that from about mid next year, you will be able to buy a fertility treatment delivered to your home, do a full cycle of treatment that costs much, much less than going to a clinic. So we're trying to revolutionize fertility, make it accessible and more affordable. And what we're working is the things that I like to do. I'm working across a lot of things around from regulatory user research, so doing things like human factors and actually simulated studies with hardware and clinical studies to make sure that we are approved as a medical device. And on the other hand, what I'm doing is a lot of physical design with other physical designers, so packaging and packaging and hardware design and creating the biggest thing that's actually UX. I'm taking experience very widely here, as you can see, Cam. but we're creating essentially a digital fertility clinic. What we're trying to figure out, I work really closely with an excellent CPO, George Thomas. What we're trying to figure out is how can we support the people for whom our treatment won't be the best. How can we support people before they need treatment? How can we support people while they're going through treatment and figure out and navigate the options and the timelines and the clinics and the doctors and the options and the healthcare and the whole field? But yeah, so that's what we're doing at Bayer. If you search Bayer, BEA fertility, there was just a great article about us on Wired.
Exciting!
A few weeks ago, so you can read all about what we're about to do, and it is exciting. It is thrilling. It is hard work. We're a small team, but the research that I do, the people that I get to speak to, is just incredible. So many people that we get to figure out how we can help their journeys. And next year we're going to be making Bayer babies.
I love that tagline as well. that's really awesome. I can't think of many more rewarding kind of things you could do as a business than helping people have kids that desperately want them.
It is incredible. And also, so as a team and as a company, we want to be evidence-based. Like I have a master's in science, and our founder, David, is one of our co-founders, the creator of the device. He's a clinical embryologist. I work with doctors and embryologists and people who know science. It's like, we're not going to do anything that isn't actually supported by peer-reviewed evidence. And being able to bring those bring that research, bring those resources into people's hands in a way that doesn't involve clinics or invasive procedures or anyone else. You can just try to take charge of that by yourself and do something, because there isn't anything. If you're trying at home and you need treatment, there is no steps in between. It's straight to tests. There's so little you can do, so we're trying to bridge that gap.
Yeah, that sounds like that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, sounds really cool. And all the links to that will be in the description as well. But yeah, I think, this will have given people a really sort of clear view of UI UX. And what's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they've got any questions about careers? Because I'm sure people will be very interested.
I really hope it's been clear. I feel like I've been waffling for an hour. It's been
amazing. No, it's been really good.
I don't know if you can tell, I'm very passionate about what I do. The best ways to get in touch with me is, well, LinkedIn. My name is in the, it's hard to spell, but it's in the podcast episode, I hope.
It will be, yeah.
And also Twitter. So on Twitter, I'm Tialina, so T-I-I-A-L-I-I-N-A. That comes from my middle name, but Tialina in, it's two I's. On Twitter is another way of getting in touch with me. I do love chatting the career with people. I'm passionate about the field. I'm passionate about my company that I work for now, and yeah, it's great.
Cool, good stuff. Well, I'm sure plenty of people will be interested in getting in touch, and it's been a really exciting conversation about UI UX, and I've learned a lot myself as well, because obviously it's not my area. So really interesting to hear about it, and awesome to get your insights. So thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, and thank you, Cam. This is my first ever podcast.
Well, you've done great. Thank you.
I've done radio before, but yeah, this is my first ever podcast. I'm very happy about this.
Cool. Well, thanks again. And thank you, listener, for checking out another episode of The Code of Career. We're here with you each Monday. Please, if you want to support the podcast, check out some of the affiliate links we have in the description. I won't endorse anything unless I personally have used the service myself or I otherwise rate it. So do check that out. I think currently we're working 0 to mastery, so do check that out. But until then, see you next time and have a great week.